V.S. Ramachandran from Madras is professor at UCSD, director of the Center for Brain and Cognition, former BBC Reith lecturer, numerous awards from the Royal Institution. He's co-authored some wonderful books, including Phantoms in the Brain. He authored Brief Tour of Human Consciousness and is about to regale us. V.S. Ramachandran.
Thank you, Roger. You can show that after my talk tomorrow.
Oh, all right. You mean this?
This, yeah. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I would like to begin by, of course, thanking Roger Bingham, the Zepp family, for putting this wonderful conference together. You've heard some really interesting talks this morning. I'm not going to talk about religion and science, however interesting that topic might be. Instead, I'd like to talk about C.P. Snow's two cultures, humanities and science. And remember, he said, never the twain shall meet. I'm going to argue that, in fact, the human brain provides the interface between the two cultures. And in a sense, this is what we do in our lab. We look at patients who have had a small change in the brain, either a damage to the brain or a genetic change in the brain, producing characteristic changes in their mind, in their behavior, and then ask ourselves, what can you learn about the normal human mind, human nature, by studying these patients? And I'm going to focus on a specific example of this, a phenomenon called synesthesia, which is originally described by Francis Galton, who is a cousin of Charles Darwin. And I'm going to start with this little quirky phenomenon and take you all the way. In fact, the original title of my talk was from Synesthesia from Molecules to Metaphor. So we're going to start with this little quirk and take you on a journey all the way to metaphor and Shakespeare and creativity, hopefully without too many bumps along the way. Okay, what's synesthesia? Well, it goes back to Galton, as I said, and he noticed that certain individuals in the population who are otherwise completely normal had the following quirk, and that is every time they see a particular number, it would be colored. So, for example, 5 would be red, 6 would be green, 7 would be blue, 8 would be indigo, so on and so forth. Or given tones might be colored. C sharp might be blue, F sharp might be green, so on and so forth. Now, what causes this phenomenon? Galton pointed out it runs in families. And since that time, so he said there may be a genetic basis. Since that time, we've also known one of the peculiar aspects of synesthesia is that it's about 8 times more common among artists, poets, novelists, and other creative types than in all of us less gifted people. And the question is, why does this happen? And this takes us into many interesting aspects of human nature, like creativity and metaphor and all of that, which I'll get to later in the talk. So there have been several standard theories of synesthesia floating around. One view is, well, they're just crazy. What do you mean 5 is red or C sharp is blue? And this, of course, is common in science. If something doesn't make any sense, you brush it under the carpet. It's called an anomaly. It doesn't make any sense, so you engage in denial, something that a lot of my colleagues are very prone to. Now, that doesn't get you very far, saying that synesthetes are crazy. The second argument is that they are remembering memories from early childhood. So maybe this chap was playing with refrigerator magnets, and 5 was red, 6 was blue, 7 was green, and for some reason he stuck with these memories into adulthood. This never appealed to me very much, because if it's true, then why does it run in families? You'll have to say the same magnets were being passed down from generation to generation, which might be true, but it didn't make any sense to me. The third argument is, well, maybe these people are just being metaphorical when they say F sharp is green or whatever. And just as we say, we have synesthetic metaphors, we say cheese is sharp, cheddar cheese. Well, cheese isn't sharp, you rub it on your skin, it's soft. So why do you say it's sharp? Well, you say, well, it's a metaphor. But that's circular. Why do you use a tactile metaphor to describe a gustatory sensation? These are called cross-sensory metaphors. So in a sense, saying that synesthesia is just a metaphor doesn't explain a damn thing. You're trying to explain one mystery with another mystery, which, as Pat Churchill would tell you, never works in science. So saying synesthesia is just a metaphor, okay, what is a metaphor? We don't have the foggiest idea, pardon the metaphor, right? So we don't know what the neural instantiation is in the brain. So what I'm going to do is turn it upside down and argue that synesthesia is a concrete sensory phenomenon whose neural basis you can pin down in the brain. I'm going to show you the evidence for that. And that, in turn, will give you an experimental lever, an experimental foothold, metaphors, for understanding things like elusive aspects of the mind like metaphor and creativity. And that's a long journey. So we're going to start with this quirky phenomenon. So the first thing we need to do is to show that, is to show that synesthesia is a real phenomenon. These people are not crazy. And I'm also going to show that this is a sensory phenomenon, not some high-level memory association or metaphor. We're going to ask what are the precise brain mechanisms that give rise to synesthesia, and then who cares? Why is this important for understanding human nature? So let's go through that. And I said it runs in families. It's more common among artists, poets, and novelists, so on and so forth. Okay, how do you show it's a real phenomenon? First of all, we found it's much more common in the general population than people believe. People used to think it's 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 1,000. We found it's about 1 in 200, and more recent estimates are like 1 in 30 or 40 people have synesthesia. So there's probably one or two of you here who are sort of ashamed to admit it. Okay, so first of all, it's very common. We found two students at UCSD, and they were seeing fives as reds and two as green, for example. So we created this computer display composed of a number of fives. Embedded in that is a bunch of twos. It's hard to find them. There's one there, one there, one there, okay? So a normal person looking at this, to find the embedded twos, like in your Ishihara test for traffic driving licenses, here you've got an embedded shape, like a square or a triangle or a circle. And then a normal person takes 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds. A synesthete immediately sees this and says, oh, I see a red upside down triangle. And he sees it much more quickly, right? And he says, I see it pop out from the background. So if he's crazy, how come he's better at it than all of us? Okay? So this shows that you're dealing with A, a genuine phenomenon, and B, a sensory phenomenon, because he says the color pops out. I can see it, literally see a triangle against a background of green fives in this case. Now, the other thing we found, which further confirms this, if you take a number that produces a color red, say, to show it to a synesthete, and then simply lower the contrast of the number, so it's gray on black instead of white on black, as you reduce the contrast, the saturation of the color drops progressively, monotonically. And in fact, by the time you get to about 10% contrast, you can still see the number, but the color disappears. So if it's some high-level memory association or cognitive phenomenon, why should it show any dependence on contrast? This shows it's an early sensory process. And there's more evidence for that, which I'll get to in a minute. Okay. Next, what's going on in the brain? Where does it occur? So Ed Hubbard, who's a graduate student in my lab, and I were looking at brain atlases, and that's the temporal lobes, and that's the fusiform gyrus in the temporal lobe. And it turns out that Semir Zeki's color area, which processes color in the brain, is there in the fusiform gyrus. It's called V4. We were struck by the fact that the number area in the brain, which is discovered by Stanislaus Dehaene and also Tim Rickard in our center, lie right next to each other, almost touching each other in the fusiform gyrus. Now, we said, what's the likelihood that the most common type of synesthesia is number to color, and these two areas are touching each other in the brain? What's going on here is there is some kind of sloppy wiring in some people. So these two areas, instead of remaining completely segregated, there's some cross-wiring, which causes every time you see a number, it activates not only a number neuron, but cross-activates a color neuron, so you see a color every time you see a number. Now the question is, why would this occur? Why would cross-activation occur in some people? So remember, the clue comes from the fact that Galton's original claim that it runs in families and there may be a genetic basis. So our idea was that in the fetus, in an early infancy, everything is connected to everything in the brain, so to speak. And then you prune away the excess connections that develop inhibition to create the characteristic modular architecture of the adult brain. Okay? And if there is a mutation in this pruning gene, which obviously will be passed down across generations, then you get defective pruning across adjacent brain regions. And if, because of transcription factors, that defective gene is expressed selectively in the fusiform gyrus, then you get a number color synesthete. So far, so good. Is there any other evidence for this idea that it's an early sensory process? Well, one of the things we found, other than the contrast effect and the pop-out effect, and this hadn't been done in the 100 years since the phenomenon had been discovered, it's pretty straightforward. Instead of showing a 5, which is numeral 5, a grapheme, what if instead of showing an Arabic 5, I should really say Indian 5 because that's where they come from, but let's call them Arabic 5. Instead of showing them an Arabic 5, supposing you show them a Roman 5, what would happen? The answer is clear in all of them. They said, well, we see the fire, but there's no color. This is important because the fusiform gyrus encodes a visual shape, not the high-level concept of five, which we think is happening higher up in the brain. You know, okay, that's just another diagram. In a region in the vicinity of the angular gyrus near the TPO junction, that's where abstract numerical concepts are represented. That's damaged. You can no longer do simple arithmetic. Okay? So you got this. What, any other evidence for synesthesia being a sensory phenomenon, at least in these subjects we had identified? Here's a striking piece of evidence. What you find is, we actually stumbled on a patient, or I should say a subject, who was a colorblind synesthete. Now, how's that possible? It sounds like an oxymoron, okay? Well, it turns out he had peripheral colorblindness, in the sense, didn't have the full complement of cone pigments in his eye, so only had a limited range of colors. But when he looked at numbers, he would see colors which he said looked like Martian colors, which you could never see in the real world, right? And he said, I can't see any of these colors in objects or in the real world, but when I see numbers, I see these weird colors. Now, why would this happen? It happens, I think, it fits my theory beautifully, because the receptors are missing or deficient in the eye, he can't see the colors in the world, but V4, the color area, is still completely intact in the brain. So what you're doing by showing numbers is activating the number neuron and cross-activating the color neuron in the brain and creating colors which you can never see in the real world because of the deficiency in the cone pigments. This immediately rules out any high-level association theory, by the way, because you cannot see a color which you've never seen before. You can't form a memory of a color which you've never seen before. Okay, now this is all true, by the way. First of all, we did brain imaging studies, we meaning Ed Hubbard, Geoff Boynton, and I, where we went and showed normal people numbers. Of course, the number area lights up, that red circle. If you show it to a number color synesthetes, the number area and color area light up. This was published in Neuron a few years ago. Even more intriguing, there was a recent study about 6 months ago where somebody did DT, diffusion tensor imaging, where you can actually see white matter, the fibers connecting areas, and found in these synesthetes, there's an actual increase in cross-wiring between these areas. So directly confirming our hypothesis. Now, all of this is fine, and it was true for the first two or three synesthetes we studied, and it was very fortunate. Then we ran across synesthetes where this wasn't entirely true. It wasn't just the Arabic number, but the Roman number five. It looked like the numerical concept evoked the color, not just the visual appearance. In fact, they would say things like, Monday is blue, Tuesday is green, Thursday is yellow. Days of the week were colored. Months of the year were colored. February is green. March is chartreuse. April is indigo, right? No wonder people thought they were crazy. What do you mean April is indigo, right? But remember the golden rule, especially if you're in neurology, if somebody sounds crazy, usually means that you are not smart enough to figure it out. Of course, sometimes they are crazy, but generally it means you don't know what's going on. Okay, what do days of the month, months of the year, and numbers have in common? Numerical sequence or ordinality. Where might that be represented in the brain? I'd like to suggest that probably is in the vicinity of the angular gyrus, where we know numerical computation takes place. There's an abstract representation of numerical sequence in that region of the brain. And then it turns out that the higher color area to which V4 projects is also in the general vicinity. So if that cross-wiring gene is expressed selectively in the fusiform, you get number color synesthesia, the lower synesthetes who are driven by the visual appearance of the number. If it's expressed higher up in the vicinity of the angular gyrus, you get the higher synesthetes where there's a numerical concept that drives the appearance of the color. You get lower synesthetes and higher synesthetes. Now comes an interesting question. Okay, now comes an interesting question. What if the same gene, instead of being expressed in the fusiform or in the TPO junction, is expressed throughout the brain? Well, I'll tell you the answer. Remember I started with the point made about Galton, and I said it's been known for 100 years, or at least 50 years, that synesthesia is about 8 times more common in artists, poets, and novelists than in the general population. So what are artists, poets, and novelists good at? They're good at metaphor, linking seemingly unrelated ideas, as when you say, it is the East and Juliet is the sun. Well, you don't say Juliet is the sun. Does that mean she's a glowing ball of fire? Actually, schizophrenics do that, but that's a whole other story, right? Normal people say, no, she's radiant like the sun, she's nurturing like the sun, she's warm like the sun, she rises in the east, rises in bed like the sun rises in the east, whatever connections your brain wants to make. And of course, Shakespeare was a master at this. So what I'm arguing is a shamelessly phrenological account of creativity and metaphor. If that same gene is expressed throughout the brain, and if you believe that concepts are also anchored in different regions of the brain, greater cross-wiring or cross-activation is going to increase the propensity to link seemingly unrelated ideas, and thereby increasing your ability to form metaphors, right? And hence, the 8 times more higher incidence of synesthesia in artists, poets, and novelists. In other words, what I'm saying is the synesthesia gene, why is it so prevalent? Why do you see 1 in 30 people having this quirk of seeing colored numbers? Natural selection would have eliminated this thousands of years ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago. Why do you have it? It's completely useless. You have it because there's a hidden agenda. In other words, it makes certain outliers in population more metaphorical, more creative, artsy, whatever, right? Now, people always ask me, so it's like the sickle cell gene. There is a hidden agenda for the synesthesia gene. So people ask me, if it's that good, how come we don't all have it? Now, that's a silly question. If we don't all have it, because evolution takes time. Maybe given another 100,000 years, we'll all have it. Another reason, which I think is the real reason, is you don't want everybody to be creative. You want genetic diversity. You don't want everybody to be creative and metaphorical. If a neurosurgeon is doing surgery on your brain, you don't want him getting creative on you, right? So it's good to have some very non-creative types and creative types in the population, preserving this genetic heterogeneity. Okay. Now, I told you about the Martian color effect in colorblind people, colorblind synesthetes. Now, I want to say that even though this is a sensory phenomenon, I don't want you to go away thinking that's all there is to it. Remember I told you lower synesthetes, higher synesthetes driven by the concept of the number, lower synesthetes driven by the visual appearance. You can make a big 5 out of 3s. What happens then? It's very interesting. If the person changes his zoom lens, looks at the trees, the trees rather than the forest, he says green. When he sees it as a gestalt, as a 5, he says, it changes. It becomes red. So this shows top-down activation of the grapheme node can indirectly influence the color that is evoked. Okay, now another peculiar form of synesthesia, which I'll tell you about, was discovered also by Galton. He pointed out if you take people in the population, often the same people who have synesthesia, but sometimes not, and you ask them to imagine numbers, they'll say, I can imagine numbers. Where are the numbers? He'll say, 1 is here, 2 is here, 3 is here, 4 is here, 5 is here, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and he'll draw an elaborate virtual line in space, convoluted, something sometimes doubling back in itself. And this was called number forms or number lines by Galton. And of course, everybody ignored it. People said, for 100 years, people said, it exists, but who knows what to make of it. Maybe they're just making it up. So again, we have to show this is a real phenomenon. By the way, it sort of reminds you of people like Einstein and other mathematicians saying that they have numerical landscapes in the brain. Numbers are spatially represented, and they wander these landscapes to discover hidden relationships. Well, is this mumbo jumbo, or can you study it scientifically? Well, these people allow you to approach this problem scientifically. The first thing we did was to show that it's real. How do you do that? Well, there's a famous effect called a number distance effect, which you can try on normal people. We all have a vague number line of sorts because numbers begin to the left, 1, 2, 3, 4, and they sort of, but you can see one here if I want to. Okay? There's no compulsion that you have to see it here. But you have a vague number line. If you give a person 2 numbers, 5 and 6, which is bigger? 6. Okay, he's a bit slow today, but 6. Which is bigger, 19 or 2? 19. Okay. So generally, if you do this systematically, what you find is the further apart 2 numbers are, the quicker the answer and more accurate. If they're close together, people are slow. He was slow, as you notice. Okay. Now, why is that? If it's just a lookup table, it shouldn't matter how far apart the numbers are. So the suggestion was there's a scalar representation of numbers somewhere in the brain, and if they're close together, it's easier to confuse them, and that's why you confuse them and you take a longer time. So we asked the obvious question. We said, if you have a convoluted number line, and 3 is actually closer to 8 than it is to 2, what determines the reaction time and accuracy? Is it the distance in Cartesian space, in physical space, or distance in numerical space that determines the reaction time? The answer is, it's strongly influenced by this shortcut distance rather than by that distance, showing once again the reality of Galton's number lines, that these things do exist. And many of these make the point they can inspect the line from different angles, see hidden relationships. One of the things we have observed was At the kinks in these lines, you find numerical computation is more difficult. They make a lot of errors. Whereas across the non-kinky regions, they make fewer errors. So this is really does exist in your brain. Now, the next question is why and where? Well, I think I have a hunch about this. Numbers are abstract, and your brain has not evolved to cope with numbers and sequence and numerical concept. Space is very primitive. Your Devonian fish-like ancestors had to represent space. So what you do in a sort of Lakoffian way is you have to map. Here is some abstract idea, and you can't deal with it. You map it onto space and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And that's how you cope with numbers, because computation in an abstract mathematical space is simply not possible. If there is some error in that mapping, okay, something convoluted happens, and you get this convoluted number line. So that's the hunch about what's going on in these people. And so what else? Let me look at my notes quickly. We're almost done. Yes, some of the number lines are in 3D. And in fact, I would venture the location. We don't know this for sure yet. I would suggest that it's also in this region of the angular gyrus. So there might be a spatial representation of sequence there, numerical sequence. And I'm predicting if you zap it with TMS and you're planning to try this, the number line would disappear. You could say, oh, I can imagine the numbers anywhere I want to. Okay. Okay, one final point. I lost my notes, but we're getting there. Okay, final point concerned. I was talking about pruning of connections, right? I'm going to talk about evolution of language, but I'm going to skip that and talk about instead. We're talking about pruning of connections, but there's also biochemical influences on synesthesia. For example, it's been known anecdotally, people who take LSD claim that they have synesthesia. And this has never been confirmed in formal studies, but I tend to believe it because it's much more common in Berkeley than here. Okay? And especially when you use LSD, it's claimed that there's an increase in synesthesia. And that gave me the clue, and this is experiment, this work I did with David Brang, a graduate student in my lab, who, as you know, may have guessed, prepared the slide. Okay? So LSD, we know, activates serotonin type 2, 2A receptors. So it gave us the hunch 2A receptors may be involved in synesthesia. And then I came across two people who, when they took Prozac, their synesthesia disappeared, right? So why would that happen? Well, it turns out Prozac causes increase in activation of serotonin type 1A, which in turn, we know, decreases, downregulates serotonin 2A, which, of course, is going to eliminate synesthesia, if our theory is correct about S2 receptors being involved in synesthesia. And finally, clinching this, a person took melatonin. We have a student who took melatonin, about 5 milligrams, and for the first time in her life experienced synesthesia, saw colors with numbers. And here, again, there's a down-regulation of 1A receptors causing an increase in the activation of 2A, thereby leading to synesthesia. So all of this fits, and we know that. So what I'm arguing is that's the synesthesia receptor. Just as I made the prediction that it's cross connections in the fusiform gyrus, and DT imaging now confirms that prediction, I'm now predicting, along with David, that the 2A receptors are the synesthesia receptors, at least for some types of synesthesia, and the gene involved is in chromosome 13, which has been identified. So the bottom line is you can start. One final point I want to make is about, let's go back to the brain diagram, is that we have seen many patients with damage to the angular gyrus of the left side of the brain, which receives information from vision, from hearing, from touch. It's at the crossroads and is a center for polymodal convergence of information, and is especially big in humans. And going back to metaphors, what I found was damage to this gyrus leads to metaphor blindness. So somehow it's involved in the genesis of metaphor. Now, why that happens is anybody's guess, but we also know that these people have problems with naming things, coming up with words. It's called anomia. Now, let's think about metaphors. Let's take a word like Juliet and the sun. How are you able to link that, and how could that possibly have anything to do with synesthesia? You're talking about two abstract ideas. But think about this. A word like Juliet or the word like sun, in fact, we think of it as having infinite implications affecting the entire brain. That's not true, right? It has a finite set of implications. Sun is radiant. It's warm. Now, there are irrelevant things like it's made of helium or it's got a lot of energy or it's hot and things like that. Similarly, now, each association can in turn generate several more, and it's geometric, right? So there are clouds of association like an echo spreading out. Similarly, the same thing with Juliet has a set of associations, but they overlap in a region, and that's what generates a metaphor. And what happens in synesthesia is because of this hyperconnectivity gene, you get more connections, creating a bigger penumbra of associations, causing greater overlap, and therefore a greater propensity for metaphorical thinking. So, last slide. Here's an opportunity for us to go from the genes, if you get a large enough family and clone it, or set of genes, and I've told you about where I think it is, and which chromosome is involved and which receptor is involved. So you can start with genes, go to brain anatomy, fusiform gyrus for lower synesthetes, angular gyrus for higher synesthetes, number line, angular gyrus, cross-wiring throughout the brain for creativity. You can go to perceptual psychophysics, the pop-out effect, the effect of luminance contrast, all the way to metaphor, abstract thinking, Shakespeare, number theory, okay? And as Pat would say, hierarchical reductionism is not bad reductionism, okay? So in fact, here's an opportunity to span the entire spectrum, starting from genes and biochemistry of synesthesia all the way to Shakespeare and metaphor. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
All right, so Ronnie, and then go to Ted.
That was wonderful. Thank you very much, Disberg. Yeah, I wonder if there's any connection between what you've done and Doug Hofstadter's models of fluid analogies, because he gave me your story about penumbras and connections, etc., something that just from the point of view of, if you might call it, artificial intelligence phenomenology, he was working on with his computer models.
Well, I'm pleased to see that resonance. I'm not familiar with that model. But it's one thing to say, you know, metaphor involves making connections and overlapping regions. Another thing to get nitty-gritty neural mechanism. So I think it's perfectly complementary enterprise.
You could interpret it as evidence.
Absolutely.
Ted.
Is this working? I think this is great stuff, and as we were talking about earlier, I think you now have a genetic explanation and a kind of neurophysiological explanation for how vague talk of things like cognitive fluidity could work, right? And this connection with metaphor is great, and I just finished my chapter on metaphor when I first read your work, and then I had to go back and rewrite everything, which is really annoying. But thank you, I guess. But the one, I think there's still a disanalogy, and I'm wondering what you think about this. You know, you mentioned Juliet is the sun. We're not projecting everything, right? We're just selectively taking things like heat or brightness. We're not taking a helium huge fusion ball. The other thing about metaphor is that it's voluntary in the sense that I know, at some level, I know it's a metaphor. And not all metaphors are like time as space seems kind of almost like synesthesia, like it's hard not to think in those terms. But Juliet is the sun is optional. And that seems different from like a color grapheme synesthete where they're really seeing fives being red or whatever. So just neurophysiologically, what do you think is going on? Because metaphor is getting bracketed in a special way where it's not interfering, it's not sensory.
Yeah. Well, two answers to that. I think that, well, the first answer is one isn't saying that that synesthesia is metaphor. I mean, this is obvious to you, but just to spell it out, one isn't saying synesthesia is metaphor, obviously not, because it's arbitrary links between numbers and colors. What one is saying is the gene that gives some people the propensity to make these artificial links between number and color is the same gene, when expressed more diffusely, confers this propensity to link seemingly abstract ideas. Now, your other question was about volitional, being able to link, see the links between Juliet and the sun. No, sorry, what was your question on that? Yes, you see both the literal and, on the other hand, the things like spatial metaphors are almost spontaneous. I would argue that they all begin like Juliet and the sun, and then they become automatic and get to the realm of you know, becoming completely automatized like spatial metaphors. You know. But one of the points I was making about the numbers being anchored in space, anchored in body, is of course an evolutionary argument. Yeah.
excuse me, Pat Churchland. So one of the things that is often seen in psychotics is a propensity to see significance and meaning and pattern and so forth, where, you know, the rest of us just see a spot in the rug. And sometimes those sorts of perceptions, it's a kind of a hyperbolic pattern recognition.
Yes.
Also leads to behavior that can turn out to be very counterproductive, or at least against one's own interest. So I'm wondering if maybe there is a story to be told about sort of excessive lack of pruning, or you know, that where the pruning back should occur at least to a higher degree than it does, and when it doesn't, you have this tendency, you know, to see the face of Jesus on a pizza or what have you.
Yeah, well, if it's expressed very selectively by transcription factors in the fusiform or in the angula, you're going to get these specific quirky synesthesias which don't do any harm. Which is, in fact, some of them say it enriches their lives. On the other hand, if it's expressed more diffusely, I said it might make you more prone to creativity. But if it's expressed too diffusely, you know, then you might get schizophrenic propensities. And by the way, they're very good at punning, too. You know, more often than metaphor, they're very good at seeing links which are almost comical. So, and nobody knows why they're good at punning, whereas creative people may not necessarily be good at punning, but they may be good at metaphor. Although Shakespeare was good at both, as you know. Okay. And on that note, one of my students, actually David, is looking at the link between schizophrenia and synesthesia to see if there is a higher incidence of that. But these are good questions. Yeah. And by the way, Tim Crow and others have suggested that schizophrenia itself, there may be a hidden agenda to those genes, which explains the very high incidence of schizophrenia. And I'm not clear about what he says that hidden agenda is. Sorry?
So it's curious that serotonin should be linked, because we know serotonin is also linked to social status. Prozac, for example, is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And so do people who are on Prozac ever have more synesthetic?
Well, no, as I said, it's the opposite. It blocks it, because the increase in serotonin, it blocks it.
Well, then, so the question is there some deeper link then? I mean, in other words, is there a social... Do people who have synesthesia have some social problems?
Well, yes, artists and poets have tremendous social problems. They're crazy.
And impoverished. Somebody run a mic up there? I mean, who's got one? Oh, Philip.
So, Rama, did you look at multilingual synesthetes to make sure that in a different language the synesthesia is in the same way? That's one question. The second one is it possible to have a reverse pop-out effect? So, for example, when you make this task with fives and twos, if instead of the twos you were to use color for someone who sees, you know, two in red, and you just show red, well, they now report seeing twos. So is there a bijective relationship sometimes between color and numbers?
And then are you asking about bilingual, or are you talking about coloring the number the wrong color?
The second question, right? So one is...
Two questions.
And the third question is, if you look at
number
line...
Let's just do two.
But hang on, it's related. So if you look at the number line, there is a bias here, because if you look for the difference between a small and large number, it will take you more time to say the large number. So the control would be to talk about two numbers which are very close one from the other, which are actually very big. So 8,000 and then 8,006, and then 0 and 6, and see the same thing.
We did do that with higher numbers, and the finding still holds up. I should tell you, this was published about 6 or 7 years ago, you know, I think in Terry's chapter or in a book chapter, and since then it's been replicated by two groups using a wide range of numbers. So that finding is solid. Now, going back to bilinguals, it's odd. Sometimes you can have, one of the things I didn't mention was you get phoneme color synesthesia too, not just grapheme. And sometimes similar sounding letters produce the same color. Sometimes letters which have similar appearance produce the same color in the different languages. So it's not a very simple, clear-cut picture, but there's a whole interesting question there about bilinguals.
Okay, two more and two more only. So who's got the mics?
John?
Is there any regularity between the association between particular colors?
Okay, that's a very good question. In other words, do all people who are synesthetes see A as red and B as green and so on and so forth? The short answer is no, there is no such link, but it's not random either. People are much more likely to see certain numbers of certain colors, higher than chance. And I think this reflects the disposition of the color map in V4, the wavelength, and the way in which form primitives are represented in the same region. So that increases the likelihood that certain numbers are certain colors, which is what we see. And also I want to mention, if you have one type of synesthesia, Dan, I'll get to you in a minute, one type of synesthesia, like number line, or color, tone color synesthesia, you're also more likely to have a completely unrelated type of synesthesia, which suggests that my argument about gene and selective gene expression is correct. Because in some people it's expressed more in a patchy manner in wider range of regions, and other people it's selectively expressed in the fusiform gyrus.
Lee Silver has a mic up there.
Yeah, hi. I enjoyed that very much, but I'm worried that it might not be as simple as just a single gene turning on and off.
By the way, it could be a subset of genes, but
right.
Come on.
So it seems to follow the same case like bipolar, which is the prototyped on sickle cell anemia, but you made a group selection kind of hypothesis. I think if Richard Dawkins was here, he'd be able to come back to the self as gene hypothesis, which is that, again, that a lower expression of this in some way is advantageous. Maybe, you know, as you say, make people more witty.
Yeah.
Guys are more witty, they get more women. And it's only the fact that it's many genes.
Doesn't work for me, by the way.
Matt Ridley says the same thing. But it's the fact that there are many genes means that's people on the edges of the bell curve basically get sacrificed because there's a heterozygous advantage. So I think, you know, it works perfectly well with the gene actually propagating itself. You don't need to use, I don't think you need to
no,
use
No, I would agree
selection.
With that. It doesn't have to be group selection. It can be kin selection. And
right,
same
right.
argument applies.
Yeah.
So let's go on to, thank you, Rama. Wonderful.